Welcome to the Aspen UK podcast, where we bring people together to discuss topics that matter.
Hello and welcome to this Aspen UK webinar. We've been running the series called The Future Of almost since the beginning of lockdown, when we've been looking at the consequences of this extraordinary time in lots of different worlds. We've had some of the global experts looking at the risks or rewards ahead. But strangely, this conversation is one that I've been planning nearly as soon as it became clear that COVID-19 might hit the UK. Angie and I were talking about compelling conversations Aspen UK could share with its community. And even then, she recognised that governments, companies and us as individuals were going to have to make incredibly nuanced and difficult choices. So I'm so very glad that we're having it in this forum. Before I introduce you to Mary-Ann Seagart and Professor Angie Hobbs, a quick introduction. I'm Penny Richards, the Director of Aspen UK. We are a forum for discussion and development, a place where ideas get debated, where they get challenged, and we hope solutions found. We usually do this through seminar programs for a diverse range of leaders. And now, rather obviously, we're hosting online. A quick explanation of today's webinar. Mary-Ann and Angie will chat for about 30 minutes, and then we'll open up the conversation for questions from you. So, a quick introduction of those two magnificent women you can see before me. Mary-Ann Seagart has spent most of her life as a journalist and broadcaster. For nearly 20 years, she was the assistant editor and political columnist for The Times, and has also worked at the FT, The Economist, and The Independent. On radio and TV, she has presented innumerable programmes like Start the Week, Analysis, The World This Week, and The Week in Westminster, and she's made guest appearances on so many more. She chairs the Social Market Foundation think tank and sits on the board of many other organisations. And she has just spent the last academic year, as a visiting fellow of All Souls, Oxford, researching and writing a book on why we don't accord as much authority to women as to men. And as I said, Professor Angie Hobbs is an old friend of Aspen UK and came to our first ever residential leadership seminar. She's the Professor of Public Understanding of Philosophy at the University of Sheffield, a position created for her after roles in Cambridge and Warwick. Her chief interests are in ancient philosophy and literature and ethics and political theory from classical thought to the present. And she has published widely on all these areas. Her most recent publication for the general public is Plato's Republic, a Ladybird expert book. She's also spoken at many of the world's most respected convenings and was on the World Economic Forum Global Future Council for Values, Ethics and Innovation. So as you can tell, probably the two best people to have this conversation. I'm really looking forward to this hour. Thank you. And Mary-Ann, over to you.
Thank you very much, Penny. I'm looking forward to it too. So Angie, you're a Professor of the Public Understanding of Philosophy. Help us the public understand what could and should be the ethical framework that should underpin how we deal with this pandemic. And I want to talk both about how the government should deal with the pandemic and about how we as individuals and communities should deal with it. So I'm putting you in number 10, okay? Oh. You are for now the UK Prime Minister. What are the various different ethical frameworks you could use to decide how the government should act during the pandemic? And then I'd like you to talk about which one you think is the best.
Yes, thank you. Well, ideally, a government would have thought through their methodologies and their objectives way before the pandemic actually hit. It's one of the things you really need to prepare in advance. In terms of methodology, you've got roughly two choices, a utilitarian approach based on the greatest good for the greatest number, or a rights-based approach, the right to life, the right to privacy, various other kinds of rights. Though, as I hope to touch on a bit later, I think possibly both those approaches could come under a more general umbrella of a politics of flourishing. I think if you're in government, it really you do need to be making utilitarian decisions within a framework of flourishing at this time. And the problem you've got is, what do I mean by good? Do I just mean saving lives from the pandemic, from COVID-19, or do I mean saving lives overall, in which case I need to be thinking about livelihoods as well, or people will die of malnutrition and suicide and so on in the future? Or, to make it even more complex, do I need to be thinking about quality of life, some kind of good life? And I think that you should take a good life approach. I think if you asked most of us, well, we can lock you in your homes forevermore. You will never go out again. Food and medicines will be delivered to you, but that is your life forever, and you will never get COVID. You'll never get a cold. Do you want that life? I think most of us would turn that down and would want some kind of good quality of life. But as we'll see later, there are definite caveats.
Yes, because I think a useful parallel here is to look at road safety. So you might sort of think what you should always do is minimise the number of deaths, okay, if you're a government or local authority or whatever, you should minimise the number of deaths. But actually, if you were to do that on the roads, you would have a speed limit of about 5 miles an hour.
Yes.
And we all accept that you actually have to weigh up the number of deaths you're prepared to accept against the convenience of being able to drive at 30 miles an hour or 70 miles an hour on a motorway, right? And so it's not a question of absolute numbers, a number of lives saved, is it?
No, I agree. But though I think we should be prepared to accept a few deaths that might not otherwise have happened, so we can protect and foster some kind of quality of life for all in both present and future generations, there are these two crucial caveats, and one is about consent. I can consent to take certain risks or withhold from those risks. Lots of people are in positions, say they're in a care home, they may have dementia, where they're not able to consent to risks that others put them under. So we need to take particular protection of the vulnerable in our society, and particularly those who are not in a position to consent. And the second big caveat is, if our policies disproportionately affect a particular community, such as the BAME community, then we know we're getting it wrong.
Okay, but if you're going to prioritise quality of life over life, then presumably you would actually release the lockdown a lot earlier so that the vast majority of us who aren't ill can have a better quality of life. I mean, how do you make that balance, make that judgment?
Well, you can't have quality of life if you're dead. So your first objective is to try to protect life, particularly in the first 2 to 3 months, when that needs to be the overriding concern. Because, you know, even if you're young and relatively healthy, most people don't want to pass it on to their parents or grandparents or vulnerable people who they know. Most people care about that. Once you get, so for 2 or 3 months, you can really prioritize saving lives. Beyond that, it gets more complicated, because then you get to issues where, if people don't have means to earn a living, they are going to really suffer from physical and mental health problems. If people are locked down in a very intense way for a very long period of time, again, there will be very serious physical and mental health problems. So I think you don't break the lockdown early. I would rather the lockdown had come earlier than it did and had lasted a little longer than it has. But I would say 2.5 to 3 months is probably the most you can consider a really extreme lockdown if you're prioritising quality of life.
Okay, so suppose you're Boris Johnson now, and a lot of your ministers are saying we should change the 2 metre rule to a 1 metre rule. And the result of that is, yes, more people might die, but on the other hand, the entire hospitality sector can reopen and travel can reopen, and the vast majority of people will be able to have more fun, be able to work more easily. What's the ethical framework for making that decision?
Again, within a politics of flourishing, you still have an obligation to protect those who are most vulnerable. And as I've said, that will often mean those who are not in a position to consent. So I personally think err on the side of caution. And for the 2 meter rule. The difficulty is going to come at the end of this summer, when if the 2 meters doesn't become 1 meter, we are really going to see the decimation of our theatres, of our travel industry, and so on. So I would say keep the 2 meter rule for a little bit longer, but not for more than maybe a couple of months, unless the scientific evidence is really overwhelming. At the moment, we have understandable disagreement amongst scientists on the 1 meter and the 2 meter rule, and the WHO are advising something rather different. And that's understandable. We haven't seen this particular coronavirus before, and we should expect, you know, reputable, distinguished scientists to disagree. But I would say err on the side of caution, keep 2 meters for a bit longer.
Okay. Now, if you're using this utilitarian ethical framework, greatest good for the greatest number, is every human life worth exactly the same amount? Okay, so suppose you are age 91 in a care home, and your life expectancy, even without COVID, is perhaps 6 months. Is the value of that life as great as that of an 18-year-old who's just left school and has their whole life before them?
Really good question, and one of the most difficult of all. I think I would want to make a distinction between the intrinsic worth, the intrinsic value of somebody's life, and whether they should receive equal medical treatment. So I think you could stick with classical utilitarianism, the utilitarianism of Jeremy Bentham, and still say each person's life is of equal value, but argue that precisely because of that, each person should have the best possible chance of 80, maybe you've just mentioned 90 years of quality and reasonably healthy life, in which case you would prioritise the treatment, if you had to choose, and give it to the healthy younger person. And that doesn't mean that the life of the younger person is intrinsically worth more than the life of the 91-year-old. It means that because they are of equal value, you can adjust the treatment to give them equal chances of the same number of years of quality life.
But might you also, in that case, say, if we want to prioritise the young because they've got more quality of life years ahead of them, then you ought to ease the lockdown more quickly so that their job chances aren't completely destroyed, so that they can get back to work, get back to study?
Yeah, yes, it's a really, again, a really good question.
The illness itself, if they get it.
Yes, that's a really good question. I mean, how much do you ask future, sort of present generations to sacrifice for future generations, but also vice versa? I would say that it would be wrong if you said, right, we are going to put so much emphasis on protecting the life of every older person in the country that we're going to completely trash the quality of life, the livelihoods of younger generations and future generations for years to come. However, that does not mean that you just let the virus rip through care homes without, you know, proper forethought. Within that framework of an ethics of politics of flourishing, which looks particularly at the lives of future generations and the young, you still need to have a duty of care towards your older generations and those in care homes. You still need to have a duty of care, as we've seen, to those who are not able to consent. So yes, you accept we are going to make sure that younger generations have some future ahead of them, and that will mean that a few people, including a few older people, will die who would not otherwise have died. But we do not accept that we therefore just let the thing rip through the older population without taking as much care as possible within that framework of a politics of flourishing.
Now, what do you say to those critics, quite a lot of them older people, like, say, Jonathan Sumption, who really resented the lockdown in the first place and said, the government is infantilizing us. We can make our own judgments about whether we want to take the risk to leave the house or not. What do you say to that?
Again, it's very interesting, and we do need to watch for increased tendencies of governments to indulge in yearnings for authoritarianism. So I accept that. However, There's a big difference between taking a risk on your own behalf, like if you go mountaineering, in which case that might be morally fine, maybe less so if you have dependents, but still you're making the choice for yourself, and taking risks on other people's behalf, particularly when they don't even know that that's what you're doing. And that's what's so difficult with this virus, because it can't be seen, because we may be pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, we do not know whose other lives we're putting at risk. So in that case, that may not have been quite what Assumption was saying. He may have been wishing for us to take cognizance of the risks we were subjecting others to, but the way he phrased it, that wasn't clear.
Hmm. And you talked earlier about future generations, and we are going to be loading future generations with an enormous amount of debt, because of the amount that we're having to borrow to get through this crisis. How would you deal with that ethically?
Yes, I mean, we've talked about how much should you ask present generations to sacrifice for future generations, but the reverse is also true. How much should future generations be made to sacrifice for us? And again, it's tricky, because you never, you know, the future is even more uncertain than the next few months. And so it's a very inexact science. But I would say that if you're really trashing the possibilities of earning a living for many, many decades to come, then that absolutely has to figure in, and you may have to risk losing a few more lives to protect that.
Okay. Well, we're going to move next on to the individual and the ethical framework that we should be using to lead our lives during this pandemic. But I just want to remind those of you who are watching that if you want to ask a question in about 15 minutes' time, if you hover your mouse over the bottom of the screen, you'll see Q&A. Just click on that. We've got four questions already, and the more the merrier. So, Angie, let's move on to the individual. What sort of ethical framework should we individually be using at the moment?
I think we should be recognising that with the best will in the world, even the most competent, morally sophisticated government in the world is not going to be able to do more than try to protect lives and livelihoods. And as we've seen, that balance in itself is immensely difficult. So as individuals, there is a huge amount we can do, both as by ourselves and in NGOs and local community groups, to protect the mental health of those around us, to check whether people in our street are okay, to concentrate on distant socialising, to help the provision of culture, dare I say it, the provision of philosophy. We've found out how desperate many people are during the lockdown for the provision of music, of poetry, of ideas. So there's a huge amount that we can do to supplement what even the most competent government in the world could possibly offer.
I just thought it was fantastic that I think 750,000 of us volunteered to help the NHS, in other words, to help vulnerable people, within about 48 hours of the government asking us to. So there's obviously a huge sort of thirst.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yes. And that's why, you know, earlier you said maybe we should just have lifted the lockdown earlier so the young could go out and have a good time. But we have seen such a fantastic response from our teenagers, and younger than teenagers, and from those in their 20s and 30s who really do care about the community as a whole, including older people, and wouldn't want to be passing on the virus to those around them. So we need to be very mindful of social distancing, whether it ends up being 1 or 2 meters. We need to be not stockpiling. And that's for our own interests as well as other people's, because if we stockpile, say, hand sanitizer, then that means others in the public who we might come into contact with are not going to be able to have sanitized their hands and are going to put us at more risk. So that all makes a lot of sense. So we, as far as possible, we do need to follow the rules.
Okay, but we're going to come across ethical dilemmas too, aren't we, individually? I mean, suppose during lockdown, I'm making her up, by the way, my daughter has severe asthma. I'm stuck in a house in London, but I happen to have a country house in a remote part of the country where I think she will be a lot safer. Do I drive down the M4?
Yes, I mean, that's one of the hardest dilemmas, because it puts into, you see the tension between the public utilitarian policy, where everybody counts the same and you make impartial, objective judgments, and the obvious fact that we love those in our family and our friends more. And of course, we should love them more. So it's a real dilemma. What do you do? Well, even under the strictest lockdown in the UK, you were allowed to take action to break the general rules if you thought that life was at stake. And the grey area is going to be, how do individual people and families interpret lives actually being at stake? I personally would be prepared to not morally judge somebody who, let's say, interpreted the rules with a certain degree of flexibility in order to protect somebody they loved. So long as they understood that the rules do need to exist, and if they were caught and if it was judged they'd bent them too much and it wasn't really a case of life being at stake, there would be a penalty to pay.
I think I can hear a little echo somewhere. I mean, everybody watching this is going to be thinking, well, what about Dominic Cummings? What did you think of that?
Yes, I mean, in a sense, that was a distraction from, I mean, the question you've asked is a really serious one about what do you do when you have tensions. Now, the Cummings family have now gone public, or it's been made public for them, that their son is autistic, and they may have felt that there were particular pressures and particular needs involved. So I don't want to judge that the particular drive north, because I don't know enough about the details with their son, and I don't want to bring people's children into it like that. The distraction there was that Cummings did know he was tending his wife, who he was certain had COVID symptoms, and then he immediately went back to Downing Street. I think that was very serious. He knew he was meant to have self-isolated for 14 days. And then the other serious thing is that when they did the 60-mile round trip to Barnard Castle with the child in the car, which doesn't seem particularly a safe thing to do if you're worried about your eyesight, to me. But in a sense, that's a distraction, because there were a lot of issues involved there, some of which could be justifiable and others of which I think definitely aren't. And I don't want to get away from the fact you've asked a real question. You've got the tension between the public person and the private person. You've got the tension between a utilitarian approach, which views people equally and makes objective and partial decisions, and the fact that, of course, we love those in our families and our friends more and want to care for them.
Okay, now what about the ethical dilemma of, do I go on a Black Lives Matter protest march during COVID-19?
Oh, yes. Now, again, really, well, in some cases, there wasn't particularly a dilemma. So I saw footage of demonstrations in Sheffield and in Cardiff, where the spaces that where the demonstrations were organised were so large that it was possible to socially distance. And gloves and masks were given out, and it all seemed perfectly fine.
It's going to make it harder for you by saying central London.
I know, exactly. Slightly more difficult. Exactly. I knew you were going to do that. Slightly more difficult in central London, where, of course, people tried their best, but it was not possible to socially distance. Two things. One, alas, COVID is not the only crisis the world is facing right now. The Black Lives Matter really matters. Climate really matters. People are going to want to protest about other very urgent issues. And we don't want authoritarian governments to take advantage of COVID and try to, close that protest down. And two, I think it might be morally possible to go to the march in central London or Birmingham or wherever, and even if you couldn't socially distance, so long as you tried to isolate for 7 days afterwards and didn't then go and have a cup of tea with your parents or something like that. So I think there are ways of limiting that. But we do need to recognise, alas, COVID is not the only game in town at the moment. And we have, in Black Lives Matter, in the climate crisis, we have at least two other very, very serious issues. And I'm not going to judge anybody who went on the marches peacefully over the weekend. I might judge those who were disruptive at the end, but I don't judge the peaceful demonstrators.
Okay. So Let's just finish by looking a bit longer term. Do you think that this crisis will make us behave more ethically in the future? Will it have any longer term effect on us as people, or indeed as a government?
We have there is that option. We have the option of recognising that socioeconomic inequalities are clearly appear to be a factor in why certain groups are disproportionately affected. So we need to look at that. We could address those inequalities. We need to value our key workers, not just through clapping, fine though that is, but also through proper protection and pay. We have the option of, we've now got some hard data of what the reduction in pollution is like if you reduce global travel by a certain amount. We have hard scientific data which we can now use to model a different future. We've had a chance to really think about what components of a flourishing life, both individually and communally, matter to us and recalibrate our work-life balance. Businesses, I think, will be very different. I think that sustainability and reliability in supply chains and so on will become enormously important, and resilience, and it won't just be a matter of profit and capital accumulation. So we have a lot of opportunities. Will we take them? Time will tell. I have two particular concerns. One is that, yes, we have an opportunity with the climate here, but oil is temptingly cheap. Governments may feel, my goodness, we have so much on our plate, we can't think about alternative energy right now.
And they've been telling us to stay off public transport.
Indeed. And many of us, including myself, I'm afraid to say, are a little wary about when I'm going to be using it again. I will. I mean, I do a lot, but, you know, I am a little bit wary about it. The other thing that could go either way is the issues we have at the moment with globalization and nationalism. So on the one hand, we've got this, you know, populist nationalist leaders who seem to be trying to exploit the pandemic to stoke nationalist and racist feelings and to increase their own authoritarian power and to assault the supports of liberal representative democracy, and that is very, very dangerous. On the other hand, we now know absolutely clearly now how interconnected all our health is, and that I can't be healthy unless I'm really holed up in my billionaire's fortress. I cannot be healthy if anybody, you know, other people around me are unhealthy. So we also have a very strong argument for integrated, intelligent, caring globalisation. So with both the climate and globalisation, I'll be really interested to see which way we go. But we have a lot of opportunities. Let's use them. It's been a terrible, terrible tragedy, but let's have some good come out of this.
Great. Well, on that cheerful-ish note, I see we've got 14 questions already. Fantastic. Whoa. So, right, which shall I choose first? Okay, here's a nice provocative one. Andrea Natalia says, thank you for the debate. Well, thanks for listening, Andrea. Let me play devil's advocate. The number of fatalities as a percentage of the population is very small, 400,000 worldwide over nearly 8 billion people. Was this all really necessary? Even with three times the number of fatalities, the number is still small. Have we overreacted?
No, I don't think we have. I mean, to begin with, we didn't know how bad it was going to be. And the people who react, the governments who reacted hardest and soonest have had the fewest fatalities, or I think in the case of Vietnam, no fatalities whatsoever. I think only 22 in New Zealand. So actually, I would say the evidence shows that those who acted swiftly, decisively, boldly, they've had the best outcomes. It hasn't gone away. It's still going to be around. So my view is that until we know more about how it operates, about what treatments are effective, and of course, ideally, we have an effective vaccine, then we still need to be very cautious.
Okay. So Hugo Dixon asks, if the government's going to use a thoroughgoing utilitarian framework, which involves trading lives off versus livelihoods, is it useful to put a value on each quality year of life? e.g. the way NICE, that's the organisation that determines which treatments should be available on the NHS, the way NICE judges medical treatment in normal times. If so, what value would you put on each year of life?
Thank you, Hugo, for a really good and really difficult question. As you know, a lot of questions have been raised about the value of the whole quality adjusted life years approach. Do you pronounce it quality? I've never known how you pronounce it. The one of the first issues is who decides on what counts as quality of life, because you obviously have worries about paternalism, if not authoritarianism here. Now, usually there are questionnaires, so the patient themselves answers questions and they make decisions on what they regard as quality life and what's important to them. But of course, in a pandemic, when people are falling ill really quickly, they may be unconscious, they may be on a ventilator, they can't go through that kind of process. So doctors and other healthcare providers are making those decisions for them. And I know from, I won't name names, but I know from personal experience that this has been going on in the COVID wards in our hospital. It is very tricky, masses of problems. I still think that adjusting towards or bearing in mind how many years of some kind of quality of life somebody might reasonably expect to have ahead of them is at least a rough guide that you can use. Imperfect though it is, raising all sorts of questions about what counts as quality and who decides though it does. It's very imperfect, but to me it's slightly better than the alternatives, which I think some of the bodies who've looked into this have also come to the same conclusion. A very tricky model, but a little bit better than the other options.
Okay. I think, have they decided it's something like £30,000 a year? I might have that figure wrong, but I think NICE does have a particular figure for...
Yes, I can't remember off the top of my head. I will go with your better judgment on that.
Okay. Alice Goff wants to know, does the government have an equal responsibility to protect non-residents, e.g. tourists, visitors to this country? Should we be as worried about us infecting them as them infecting us?
I would like to think so. I would like to think that, you know, the morals of hospitality, anybody who's currently on these shores, whatever their status as a resident or a non-resident or a visitor, would get the same treatment. This is particularly relevant in respect of our detention centres. So when COVID hit, I think 700 detainees were released into the local community, and something like 361 were still there. That was at the start of COVID. I don't know the figures now. Unfortunately, those 700 were released into local communities. They weren't all released into local community care, because some local councils decided, well, these are not, you know, they're not citizens, they're not British citizens, their immigration status has not been settled, we don't have the same duty of care. I find that morally very unfortunate, but also pragmatically foolish, because again, you do not know quite who has this disease and who could be passing it on, and we all know how interconnected all our health is. So for both practical and moral reasons, I would want everybody who happened to be locked down on these shores to receive the same treatment.
Hugo Dixon tells us a quali is worth £25,000 a year. So thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Jacob Harris asks, what do you say to those who claim that the coming scandals stripped the British government of the little moral authority it had left? And what is moral authority anyway?
I suppose moral authority would involve asking other people to do something for moral and having the moral sort of rectitude to back up what you are saying, and people would trust you and do it because they could see you were doing the same thing. Well, I started out the pandemic, I really wanted to have as much sympathy as I could for our government, because they're not my government, but they're not a government I voted for, but I wanted to have sympathy because this is the most difficult crisis, I think, that has hit the world since World War II. It is incredibly hard, as we have seen, even within, we've only looked at the problems within utilitarianism and how it might fit in with a bigger politics of flourishing. We've even left out all the tensions with rights-based thinking. And the people who say, hang on, you know, you say I can be sacrificed for the greater good, what about my right to life? There is a lot we have left out. It is really hard. However, I do feel, let me be as generous as possible, I do feel that what had not happened was any thoughtful planning about these kind of, what's your basic methodology? What are your basic objective or objectives? What would you do if a pandemic was on the way? Even though we have known since at least 2016 that pandemics were rated as the number one threat to the UK, above terrorism, above everything else. So we've had plenty of warning. We had, in this particular case, we had several weeks, if not a couple of months of warning from the Far East. I don't think the planning happened. And it's not just about accumulating PPE and ICUs, crucial though all that is. It was just about thinking. Thinking is relatively cheap. Philosophers would say far too cheap, but it's relatively cheap. It did not happen. So lack of planning, and then when the pandemic was clearly happened, I cannot escape the feeling that there was complacency, there was a certain amount of arrogance, there was a certain amount of exceptionalism. Oh my goodness, you know, of course it's going to be chaotic in Italy. I used to live in Italy. Italy has a fantastic healthcare system. And if they were struggling, then we were going to struggle. And Italian, you know, doctors were warning us. And I don't think the warnings were taken seriously. I think they thought it was going to be different in Britain. So I'm afraid lack of planning, lack of forethought, everything happening. And as a result, everything, in my view, happened too slowly. The lockdown happened too slowly. We're now actually probably releasing the lockdown, in my view, too early. Obviously, the supply of PPE for key workers was way too slow. So this use of care homes, issues of detention centres, issues with the homeless were not addressed quickly enough. So I wanted to be sympathetic as far as I could, but I'm afraid they tested my sympathy to the limits and it broke.
Okay. Let's take a step back, because we haven't actually talked about a rights-based framework. And if the government were to use that instead, how would it balance the right to life versus the right to earn a living, for instance?
And I think, yes, and I think the reason they haven't used that framework is that they would actually be back with some of the same problems that you get with utilitarianism. You're still going to be saying, well, how many, you've got these clashing rights, how many rights do you, you know, do you go for the greatest majority of rights, or do you say the right to life always trumps the right to a livelihood, but you can't say that because if people have no livelihoods, then eventually they will die, either through health reasons or through suicide or whatever. So I do understand that in this crisis, the government, they took a roughly utilitarian approach, and I don't blame them for that. Jeremy Bentham, in his, you know, his initial tract of classical utilitarianism, he aimed it specifically for governments and judges. It was meant to be a public policy. But of course, what we have seen is that I don't think that even within the utilitarian framework, they thought through exactly what they meant by good or what they meant by number. Did good, as we've seen, mean life or quality of life? Did number mean just people alive now or future generations? I think they've actually, to be fair to them, I think they've eventually got the order of priorities right, and that they started off protecting life and now they're widening it to protect livelihoods and quality of life as well. And I heard Matt Hancock talk about we need to protect, you know, lives worth living and not just lives the other day. And I think they've got that order right. I think it was the timing they got so wrong. And that was due to the lack of preparation. And I think, I'm afraid to say, the complacency and the arrogance.
Okay, well, on that note, actually, not complacency and arrogance, but life worth living. Daniel Lack asks, can you speak more about the flourishing model? If this is a model governments around the world are using, and if so, can you give us some examples?
guess the key example is wonderfully Bhutan, which doesn't measure a gross national product, but gross national happiness. It is at the top of my list of countries that I want to explore. I would love to go to Bhutan. We can but dream. I can't speak for the governments around the world. I've heard the rhetoric of flourishing used most in New Zealand, in Canada, to some extent in Germany, certainly in Greece. Interestingly, countries that have done pretty well in the current crisis. I did hear David Cameron, he actually started to talk about happiness and flourishing and the good life quite a few years back. So we do see some of it here, and we've had a slightly queasy. There are problems. It's not unproblematic in itself, because who decides what physical and mental and emotional capacities allow you to flourish? Where does it leave people who have one or more of those capacities impaired? Are you going to be, does it mean that people with certain disabilities can't flourish as well? Who gets to decide? Is there a route to authoritarianism or paternalism here, or can a certain measure of autonomy be built in? So it's not unproblematic. It's what I work on most myself. And I do think it is the most helpful way forward, not just for governments, but also for business. But I'm not pretending it's easy.
Well, we do actually in this country, since David Cameron, we do still measure general well-being every year. And yes, that's self-reported. So that's how you measure it, is actually by asking people.
It is. I mean, unfortunately, from a philosophical point of view, whether flourishing is something that can be measured in units would be problematic to start with. This whole sort of attraction of utilitarianism for governments and economists and business leaders is that it deals in sums. And though the sums are very difficult to work out in practice, and I would say impossible, you're at least dealing with commensurable units. But whether that, I personally am very, very skeptical about the attempts to very strictly measure happiness. I think that certain qualities can't be put into quantifiable form. So I'm advocating, again, I'm afraid, a very imperfect system here, but I still think one that's better than the alternatives.
Okay. Jennifer Williams says, you suggest we have to abide by government diktats, but we're seeing a rise in authoritarianism and nationalism, as you mentioned. Yeah. Should their citizens still respect their instructions?
Oh, goodness me. Good, good question. And that's why I have, I have supported within reason the Black Lives Matter protests this weekend, even when the government said don't go. You're absolutely right. We have, even before the pandemic hit, we had a rise in populist nationalist governments, in autocrats and would-be autocrats and indeed tyrants, and we are certainly seeing that exploited at the moment. We've seen, to the point where we're getting unidentified militias on the streets of Washington DC. So it's a real problem. And my own view is that the reason I'm still following the rules pretty much is not particularly because the government has told me to do so. As I've suggested, it's a government which does not currently have my particular respect, but because I think on the whole, the rules at the moment are the best rules to follow in terms of protecting my fellow citizens and myself. So I'm doing it mainly because I think it's the right thing to do rather than because I'm told. If my government tells me to do something that I feel is really wrong, then I will not do it. I would rather break the law than do something I feel to be immoral.
Okay. So Christina Topham asks, do you feel that we, the people, want an ethics-led government or a pragmatic one more concerned for a thriving economy?
Yes, I think I would want to slightly break down that disjunction between ethics and the economy, because for me, economic issues are profoundly ethical, because if people are not able to support themselves and their family, then there are huge there's huge unhappiness and ill health for them. There's going to be a rise in inequalities and civic unrest and so on. So for me, having the ability to earn a living in a society which is to some extent working economically is an ethical issue. So as we've talked about, you're balancing whether, you know, how many lives are you prepared to risk to protect that bigger picture? Do you know what, I mean, what Marianne was saying earlier about the number, what was the number again of the people who within 48 hours volunteered to help the NHS?
Three quarters of a million.
Yeah, I mean, fantastic. I mean, and all the initiatives that we've seen going on, I mean, I'm seeing it in my street, absolutely wonderful. I think on the whole, and leaving views on politics aside and politicians aside, I think on the whole, we are a kindly and fair and tolerant bunch who on the whole want to help. I think people do want ethical government. And as I said, I don't think that needs to mean living in, you know, hair shirt poverty, because I see economic sufficiency as an ethical issue.
Good. Andrea Tartaglia has got another question, which is also interesting. Everyone mobilised willingly to fight this terrible tragedy. The same mobilisation is not happening for environmental issues. Why do you think that is? It's a question of urgency more than anything
else.
Yes,
I do think so. So we have an enormous temptation as the human race to kind of put off worrying about even terrible things unless they are absolutely upon us. And though I still think the climate emergency is a bigger issue than pandemics for us as the human race, I still think it's the top issue right now, because the whole survival of the planet depends upon it. We have this great temptation to sort of push it off into the long grass. Whereas back in early March, I remember even before there was the official lockdown in the UK, I and a lot of people I knew were basically locking ourselves down anyway, ahead of what the government said, because we could see that until we had effective treatments and until there was a vaccine, ideally, social distancing was our best measure. Because the challenge that, you know, and the number of people who thought, I don't know the situation behind the scenes about whether herd immunity was ever considered, but it was certainly being mooted in the press and in social media. I don't know the truth of what went on behind the scenes, but people were saying, well, this, you're asking me to, do I want to die, not just sort of generally vaguely at some time in the future caused by the earth burning up, but do I want to die in April? Do I want to die in the next few weeks? No, I don't fancy that at all. So it was the absolute urgency and people realizing, you know, they might die really, really soon, within weeks, and thinking, no, I am going to do something about that. So that impressed itself upon us. But our tendency, I think, is to be a little bit lazy and a little bit unimaginative and to take the easy option. And that's a bit is what's been going on with the climate. However, I am hoping, I really hope that because we have seen this, I think a 20% reduction in pollution and a lot of measures at the height of the lockdown, and we've seen the benefits for air quality, for wildlife. I mean, who hasn't loved listening to the bird song at the moment? It's gorgeous. We're hearing wonderful reports about sea life off Thailand and so on. I'm really hoping people can see how all this is connected. And we could use this as a wonderful boost against the climate crisis. Let's see what happens.
People might think we've got enough to worry about with COVID and it gets pushed to one side.
Well, except surely, you know, we've got interconnections there too. In, you know, there are, we don't yet know the exact causes of the coronavirus or where it came from, but whether for wildlife wet markets or whether for research or whatever, there have been encroachments around the world into forests and various viruses are, you know, becoming mixed up in the human population, which we have so far got no immunity towards. So, you know, climate and how we treat the planet, how we treat the environment is linked to global health.
Yeah, but that's not going to stop me driving up the M3 rather than taking the 817 to Waterloo, is it?
I know, and as I said, you know, we're going to be wary probably of using public transport for some time. It's going to be very difficult. We have to keep fighting for the climate. It is the biggest thing, and we care about our children and our children's children, and it's going to affect them more than us. So I hope we don't lose sight of it.
Okay. Sarah Hassan asks, if you could name one piece of literature or educational resource that a head of state could benefit from in planning their COVID-19 response, what would it be?
Oh, okay. Well, I trained as a classicist initially, and I turned immediately to Thucydides in book two of his History of the Peloponnesian War and the terrible plague in Athens at the end of the 5th century BC. Because I thought until we get effective treatments and a vaccine, we're roughly in the same position. And it was all about social distancing, taking particular care of your key workers, and not having a fairly positive mindset and not just sort of assuming that everything was hopeless too quickly. I then turned to Ficino, end of the 15th century, also writing, and he wrote a book about it, you know, in time of pestilence, and again, social distancing. So yeah, let's learn a little bit from history. In terms of, are you wanting a book of advice, or are you wanting something more inspirational for them?
I don't know. You choose. Inspirational, maybe.
You choose. Inspiration.
Which philosopher should they read?
Which philosopher? Historian. Which philosopher should they read right now? Goodness me. I'm always going to say Plato. I'll stick with Thucydides. I'll stick with people who've been through plagues before in our history and how societies rebuild and the advice they give, because we have had terrible plagues before and the human race has come through it. And I think it's helpful to remember that. And also helpful to remember that with all our 21st century medicine, until we learn more about the treatments and the vaccines and what's going to work, we are roughly in the same position as Renaissance Florence and 5th century Athens.
Yeah, salutary. Okay. So do you think any of the positive changes and sensitivities this situation has created will be permanent, or are we fundamentally selfish and short-sighted, and will we go back to how things were? Now, it seems to me, I remember after the 2012 London Olympics, there was a fantastic, certainly as a Londoner, there was an amazing sense of community spirit. And you talked to complete strangers on the tube. And I remember thinking, wouldn't it be lovely if it stayed like this? And of course, it had vanished. On the other hand, we have now, certainly those of us who live in cities, we have met our neighbours in a way that we hadn't before. And we have often cared for our neighbours in a way that we haven't before. And surely that's not just going to evaporate, is it, in 3 weeks?
I don't think it will. I think this will be a little bit different. I mean, I take your point. As a race, we tend towards being rather lazy, rather selfish, rather complacent and short-sighted. I take that, and we're all, you know, can be at fault there. But I do think we're not going to go, it will be a new normal. It's not going to be the same. For sheer economic reasons, we're going to see business behaving differently. If not for moral ones, I would hope for moral too. We are going to see emphases on resilience and sustainability in production and supply chains. We are, I hope, going to see paid sick leave, ideally by governments and certainly by businesses when governments fail, because the terrible, terrible harm that can be done by people feeling that they have to go into work for economic reasons, even though they know they're displaying symptoms of a really terrible virus. I mean, are just so catastrophic.
In the gig economy who don't get statutory sick pay.
Yes, indeed. Really crucial. So I do think for economic as well as moral reasons, we are going to see changes. I think we are going to see at least a slight reduction in pollution. I think at least some of us think, my goodness me, it was absolutely lovely. Wasn't it lovely when the wildlife took over and the air was so clean? I think there will be at least more people walking and cycling to work. I think more of us will stop and chat to our neighbours a bit more. We've got to know them so much better. So I don't think all the goods are going to evaporate. And as I've, you know, I think one of the main things is going to be the work-life balance, because a lot of people have found out that, you know, they can work more. Not everybody, we're privileged, those of us who can do that, but those of us who are privileged to be able to do at least some of our work from home have thought, well, do I really need to, you know, do we really need to have all the meetings physically, you know, taking transport to do so? I think that will be different. And I think we have had a chance to reflect on what really matters to us. Now, how long will that last? I think it will last a generation or so. I think this is going to turn out to be pretty profound, partly because sadly it's not over. This is, the virus is not going to disappear quickly.
Well, it's actually around my last question, I want to go to Tobias Svensson, who says, we might be a kindly, fair and tolerant bunch in the UK, but can we maintain that for another few months or for another lockdown if we perceive our government has let us down? Do you think we've reached the limits of our tolerance?
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, I think we're kindly and tolerant towards our neighbours and our fellow citizens, and I hope our guests on the whole. Will we continue being feeling kindly and tolerant towards the government? Well, I mean, I don't anyway at the moment.
If there were another lockdown because we got a second spike.
Yes.
So cross about it that we just wouldn't abide by the lockdown the way we have done.
Yes. Well, it's complicated because if there was another lockdown, then you're getting into areas where it depends how long it was and how strict it was. Because again, if it went on for more than 6 to 8 weeks, you would again get really even more severe economic problems. I mean, the more lockdowns there are, the more impossible it's going to be for businesses, you know, who keep opening up and then closing down again. It's going to be really, really hard. So I think there would be real problems there. That was one of the reasons I wanted the lockdown to be bold, hard, early, and to go on for a bit longer than it has. I thought, let's get through the pain now, because there will be real difficulties in doing it in the future.
Angie, it's been fascinating talking to you. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sure everyone watching has enjoyed it too. So thank you very much, and I'm going to hand over to Penny now.
Can I just say thank you for your really good questions and sharing, and thank you to all the audience. I've hugely enjoyed this. It's been a real pleasure and an honour to be invited on, and I hope we all keep the conversation going, because that's what Aspen is for.
It is, and I'm just going to add thanks to both of you. Jo, it's so good to know that we are a kindly, fair and tolerant bunch. Thank you for reminding us. At the same time, as Angie knows, and she's just alluded to it, in normal times, Aspen UK brings really amazing diverse groups of people together to reflect on issues that matter and help them debate and confront their own ideals and values. And Angie, I was just thinking that of all the webinars we've been delighted in hosting, this is probably the closest to what we do in real life. And it was such a pleasure to linger and listen to both of you. Amazing questions, Marianne, and just a beautiful, thoughtful hour. And thanks for sowing seeds for all of us to mull over as well. That's a lot of things you said and a lot of reflections you've given us are going to stay with, I think, a lot of us. And now join me in thanking Angie and Marianne, unfortunately only virtually, these thanks, for such a remarkably compelling hour. Thank you. See you soon, I hope, and have a good evening.
Thank you.
That's it for now. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow us on Twitter @UK_Aspen. And to stay up to date with our work and future discussions, check out our website at aspenuk.org.
This is a Right Angles production. You can find out more by visiting rightangles.global.